is Writers' Voices. You're listening to Writers' Voices on KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond. KRUU is a community-supported, solar-powered station. I am Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, standing in today for the regular host, Monica Hadley, and her mother, Carolyn. With me today, I'm pleased to report, I have Wendy Del Sol. She's an author from Des Moines, Iowa, and has had tremendous success in the last few years. Wendy started writing novels at age 40 after studying at UCLA's Writers Extension Program and at the Iowa Summer Writing Festival. She sold a young adult novel, Stork, to Candlewick Press, and I wish that you could be in the studio with me to see what a beautiful book this is. It's really a very attractive cover on this book. In addition to selling Stork to Candlewick, she also sold a second book, a sequel, Frost. That book will be published in 2012. In addition to that, she sold a third book, an adult novel, The McLeod Home for Wayward Girls, and it's slated for publication by Berkeley Books, an imprint of Penguin, and that will come out in August of 2011. Wendy's first book, Stork, came out in October, just a few months ago. Wendy was born in Canada to British parents, and she grew up in the suburbs of Detroit. A graduate of Michigan State University, she studied in Paris for a semester, traveled to Nice, and then earned a master's degree from California State University in Long Beach. She lived in California for 20 years, worked in the travel industry for 10, and moved with her husband and two sons to Iowa in 2005 for her husband's job. And the family now lives in a suburb of Des Moines, Waukee, Iowa. So welcome, Wendy.
Thank you so much. Really, my privilege to be here.
Oh, we're really thrilled to have you visiting with us today. I noticed that you recently moved, or I guess about 5 years ago, you moved to Iowa, and the character, the main character in your book, moves from, I think it is LA.
From LA, yes.
To Iowa. So was that
She
part
moved
of
to Minnesota. Yes, I chose Minnesota.
The Midwest, yes.
Just to be a little colder.
And was that part of the, like, what was the inspiration for Stork?
Yeah, you know, it was not the inspiration that she would be a new girl. However, I think that the formula you use in fiction is take your character from to somewhere difficult and conflicted. So I just kept upping the ante for her. So not only would she discover that she has this unwanted and new paranormal ability, she would be the new girl out of her element, somewhere she didn't want to be, going through her parent, you know, enduring her parents' divorce, having to move to Minnesota. So it really was just, I guess, kept spinning it and spinning it. How much harder can I make it for her? So, and then, of course, having gone myself through a relocation with it, I think it was, I started that manuscript a year after moving to Iowa. It was just, those were, even though, of course, I was an adult, and thank you for sharing that I started writing at 40, by the way. So everybody can do the math.
I think that's
9 years ago.
Inspiring,
yes,
though,
thank
for
you.
Many people.
Yes. So I think that, you know, I had myself, even at that age, gone through, you know, new girlitis, if you want to give it a name, because it is, it's even, you know, even as an adult, it's not easy to be the new person somewhere. It's an adjustment.
Well, of course, that's a story that's been told many times before, like New Kid in Town. It's like city mouse, country mouse kind of tale. But you put a very unique and original spin on it. And where did those parts of the story, the fantasy elements of your story, come from?
Right. So the paranormal ability that I assigned to my 16-year-old main character, her name is Katla, or I call her Kat. She likes to be called Kat. She discovers that she is a human stork and has the ability or responsibility to match the hovering of unborn souls with the correct mother. And, you know, I knew that if I was going to break into the YA market, the young adult market, or just to attract the attention of an agent and eventually an editor at a publishing house, that I really had to have something that's called high concept or fresh, which, you know, I had not heard of that. I do think that I invented that paranormal ability. To my knowledge, there are no human storks out there. So I think that, you know, I mean, obviously you mentioned that the new girl is not original, that, you know, I really felt that I needed to find something that was high concept enough to attract the interest of the publishing industry.
Did you study screenwriting? That sort of sounds like a script writing, screenwriting kind of concept.
I did not. No, I love movies. I do not have a background in script writing. I do not have a background in English. I mean, I have a university degree, but I studied political science at college, all the way through my master's. So I just think a love of story and spinning stories, it's just something I've always been interested in, though I didn't dare until I was 40, ironically.
Hmm. So how did you settle on this particular slant that she would be a human stork? Were you interested in childbirth?
I guess I've always been fascinated by the angel stories, and there really is a true genesis to the germ of the story is, years and years ago, I was watching Unsolved Mysteries on TV, which used to be one of my favorite shows because, like I said, I love ghost stories, and I believe all of them, of course, everything. And there was a story on there once about a boy who, he was preternaturally smart. He could talk at a very young age and probably a gifted child. And he told his mother, probably less than 2 years of age, that he chose her. He remembers flying around and getting to choose his mother. Now, of course, I have no idea how, what goes into the making of some of the unsolved mystery stories, but apparently this was a true story, and it just stuck with me for years and years. So many years later, as I was, it was on a drive, actually, and I was thinking, all right, I want to do something fresh and unique, and I did know that the paranormal, I mean, it was already post-Twilight. I had not read Twilight yet, but I did know that it was, Twilight was a blockbuster, and I was just thinking, well, what is different. I mean, I did not want to do vampires. I didn't want to do werewolves. Nothing wrong with them. I just thought that if I was going to, like I said, if I was going to break out, I really needed something of my own. And this came to me, that story of this little boy who claims that he remembers having an out-of-body kind of experience and getting to select his mother. So then I kept spinning it. Well, the what if? And then it came to me the symbolism that we use in many cultures, not just Western culture, but primarily Western culture, of this stork, this white bird that delivers human babies. So I sort of took both, and I made these white witches, which I thought white witch is a witch who does good, which is perfect for a white bird. And I just kept spinning it all and marrying it and blending it until I had my main character.
And how did the, I think there's an element of maybe like Norwegian?
Norse mythology. I use Norse mythology. And I think a lot of writing is just accidental or just synchronism, that it all just comes together. That once I had decided that, even though we had moved to Iowa, I did want to go one climate colder, because I really wanted her to experience almost, and small town, just as big a change as she could from Los Angeles. So I decided to set in Minnesota, and Iowa as well, but Minnesota has these pockets of Scandinavian communities. And once I thought of the Scandinavian background, all the Norse mythology just kind of tumbled into the mix. I thought, well, oh my gosh, how rich is Norse mythology to come up with some of the cosmology for these women, what they would believe in. Pre-Christian would be Norse mythology. And I settled on Iceland as a community. So she's of Icelandic descent. And of course, there are the Icelandic sagas that I was able to tap into. And it really just, its name is very evocative, Iceland. And it's an island, and I think most of us don't know very much about Iceland. And I don't know why, but I have always had a fascination with Iceland. So all of these things just kind of tumbled into it, and I just kept spinning it.
Do you have any shared ancestry with your character?
I do not. I often people ask me if I am, Icelandic. I'm English. My background is English. My parents were born and raised in England. So, no, I don't. Which actually made it even all the more fun to research.
So, what form did you take? Like, what form did your research take then?
Really, it's books and we're so lucky now with the internet that just thinking about when I started writing 9 years ago, how much more I went to the library and just checked out books. But what's accessible, even excerpts from published books online, we're very lucky now to be writing during this, you know, the sharing of information age. But most, it's just books and internet and looking at maps and reading blogs from the area.
Now, you were in the travel industry for 10 years.
I was, yes.
Did you ever go to Iceland?
I have never been to Iceland,
Are
no.
you thinking of
I would love to go. So Stork is the first in a trilogy, and the second book, Frost, which you mentioned, comes out in September. It takes place in Iceland. Oh, not all of it, but there's a certain section that takes place in Iceland. And like I said, you were so lucky. I can actually Google map, you know, areas of Iceland, and
pictures.
you can have a visual picture of it. So as far as describing and setting a tone, I really was surprised at how much I was able to do online and look at towns, look at the architecture, get a flavor for what. Of course, it's all fictional, so I have that license as well. However, there is just so much that I would love to go to Iceland, but that was not in my budget.
And you have two teenage boys at home.
I have two teen boys as well, right? I'm not sure that that would go over well with my husband.
But you have mentioned that this book is planned as a trilogy. I mean, is the first in a trilogy. Was that always your intention?
I would say that I started writing it with just this germ of an idea, and as I was finding new material and developing the storyline, I realized fairly quickly in that I had enough for more than one book. And I also knew moving into the YA genre, the young adult genre, having all my manuscripts before that had been women's fiction, that that particular reader likes, once they invest in a character, they like more than one book. And that's just something that's understood in the industry, and I already knew that about the industry. So once I came to know my characters in the town, and I was able to stretch this out into three books. It probably started as a standalone, mm-hmm. a single title. However, very quickly, in less than halfway through the manuscript, I started stretching it into three books. And I always knew it would be a trilogy. I just think three is a nice number, and I wanted to then be able to at least outline for three books.
Now that you've written the first two, do you have any feeling it could extend to more than three books?
I actually do not think that it will. However, you never, you know, if it were incredibly successful, I'm not sure. But right now I'm in the process of writing the third book, and I will be giving it a fairly definitive end. And I had that end in mind already when I was writing the first one. So I doubt that it would go beyond that. I would really need to get creative, and I guess I'm not sure. Because with the ending I have in mind, I don't think it would continue.
Okay. So we know that you pretty early on decided you were going to do a trilogy. How did this work with submitting the book? Did you submit it as the first in a trilogy? And tell us a little about the process of your submitting it.
Well, I guess backing up is you first need an agent in this business. There is no submitting to editors at major houses unless you have the backing of an agent. So the first step was to acquire an agent. And she read the manuscript, and I believe my query letter said that it could have been a standalone. Even in its first draft, maybe certain things we could have not left certain things as ambiguous as we have in the first book.
And so when you say we, you're talking
about my agent,
Jamie.
Yeah, Jamie Brenner.
And what, she's with Artists and Artisans?
Artists and Artisans,
And
yes,
how did you select that agency?
I had seen, I subscribed to Publishers Weekly. It's an online kind of a news source, and she had made a recent sale. So I was making a list of agents that would go on to my, a couple dream agents that had really big projects out there. And because she'd had a recent sale and her name popped up, I just added her to my list. I queried, and nowadays querying is all, it's all online. So it used to be mailing and waiting for weeks, but now it's fairly instantaneous. And she, I think I queried less than 10 agents for this project.
And those were, you were sending out snail mail packages of some kind?
Once, or, way in the day for other manuscripts. On this one, I think I only sent email queries.
Okay.
And
so you
less than 10. Okay. And Jamie, which is never happens in this business, but so it's a sort of a fun story to tell. She got my query letter on a Tuesday, and she emailed me back right away on that same day. In that same afternoon, she said, "This sounds interesting to me. I'll take the full," which never happens. You never get a request for a full right away. Generally speaking, they'll say, "I like it. I'll take a partial," which means 20 to 30 pages. They take that partial. They'll have it for, they could be 3 months that they hold on to a partial, 2 to 3 months. And then they might ask for the full, having taken that long with 30 pages or 50 pages, whatever they asked for specifically. So the fact that she said that she would take the full was such a shocker. I actually had factored in enough time that I had time to polish the end, and I had the first 50 pages pretty...
Oh, you weren't expecting to have to send the
whole
thing.
No, I was not
quickly.
And I had just finished the first draft of the manuscript.
That's fortunate.
So she read it. So she got... I think that next Wednesday morning, I sent it to her. I thought, well, if she's interested...
The whole book.
The entire thing, the whole manuscript. I just hit that send button, and I don't know if everyone's had that moment where you just go, oh my gosh, I just potentially made the biggest mistake. I think I put my head down on my desk
Just because you thought maybe you should have polished it more?
Oh, yes, and I knew there were certainly typos, and it really was a first draft. So by that night, she was emailing me back saying things that no writer ever hears with a first draft. She's saying, I can't put this down. She said it like 3 times. I love, love, love your writing. And something to the effect that I laughed out loud. So it was all good. I knew, and she signed me on that Friday for this project.
Okay, so people who are listening to this, let me just remind our listeners. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. You're listening to Writer's Voices. I'm the guest host today for Monica Hadley and her mother, Carolyn. With me as my guest is Wendy Del Sol. She's an author from near Des Moines, Iowa, Waukee, and she's had tremendous success in selling 3 books recently, and she's just telling us quite a tale about her first contact with her agent. So some people listening to this story are going to maybe develop unrealistic expectations about what could happen, but I'd like to backtrack a little because your story is so unusual. What kind of information did you put in that initial email that you sent out to like 9 or 10 agents?
Well, ironically, mostly now they just want a 1-page query letter. So the first paragraph just says, my name. I write YA fiction. The name of my you give a word count. So it was 70,000 words probably, and it's paranormal with a love story. I think I said it was light fantasy with a love story. And then you have about 2 paragraphs where you essentially can just give a very quick summary of the story, and then you have a bio paragraph where you invent. In my case, I'm a freelancer. I had some freelance writing experience, but I mentioned that I'd been through the UCLA Writers Extension Program and the Iowa Summer Writing Festival. I was very thin on bio experience. It does show you that agents do read their query letters. So many writers think that they have to go to a conference or that it is a business of who you know and, backdoor introductions. I had no contacts. It was a 1-page query without backup pages. She hadn't even... Until she read the query, she had no first page, nothing. She just asked for the full based on the query. But just, I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier. It was a high concept idea, so she was curious.
It was something she'd never come across before.
I'm assuming that's what caught her interest.
That was what caught my attention when I read it. It was completely unlike, I'm not a real fan of vampire books, and yours isn't, but I couldn't even put it in a, I couldn't say this is a sword and sorcery or this is a vampire book. It was its own thing. It's a fantasy with a really different premise. So that was very cool.
The majority of it does take place in, it's just a modern high school setting. So it really, I'm not building another world per se. She's going to the homecoming dance and she's experiencing all these things, but she has this life she also can't discuss with her parents. And
okay, this got me off into a tangent because I started thinking about her going to the high school dance. There is a scene in your book where the character is, the main character, Kat, is very fair, very blonde, and you have her in this like red dress. There's this scene, and I could really picture, if this is ever made into a movie, some gorgeous young, you know, pale actress with this beautiful red dress. You mention a lot in the opening of your book about what this character wears. Now, I'm kind of, even though like I just wear my normal cords and, you know, t-shirts living in Iowa, I'm interested in fashion, so I had a good time imagining what your character was wearing. Because when she comes from L.A., she's really interested in fashion, and it's not exactly the norm where she moves in Minnesota, and she is unimpressed by the clothing of other people. Did you have any concerns about people thinking she was shallow, or you include some actual brand names? Did you have any concerns about including these brand names that maybe you'd be criticized for, like advertising? I can't even remember what they are.
Well, you know, reading is such an individual experience. Some people really enjoy that aspect of the book, that she is this real teen, and many teens are into brands and names. I'm going to tell you right now that I personally am not like that. I have said for many years that I could do a testimonial for a discount store because I don't shop like that. And I had to research. I honestly had to research the names of and ask people for, and you know, people who knew these things. So this is not a part of my personality that I am, you know, lending to my own character. I am not like that. So it was fun to...
It's kind of cute to know because before I was going to meet you, and I was thinking, what am I going to wear? I started pulling on my normal outfit.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, I better at least put on a skirt.
And here I just have pants on. So, yeah, so it was, I mean, there are people who have said that they find, you know, that a little shallow. But I think that my character grows. And in order to show growth in a character, she does have to start in a place where you can actually have measurable growth. So by the end, she realizes that her new classmates can't afford what she afforded. I think I explain it because her grandmother in L.A. is French and very fashion conscious, and is her bankroll for her many shopping trips that she had in L.A. It was fun to research, and
especially I imagine since you have boys and you don't have any daughters that you've dressed up, it would be a completely new thing for you.
I just have never had that budget either, personally.
Okay, so we were talking about you attracted your agent with this letter completely like a cold call.
It was a cold
letter. You weren't recommended by anyone.
I was not.
I think that's very inspiring for people to know. You really don't have to know someone.
I think that a lot of people don't think that you can. However, as long as the material is and the pages stand up to, you know, once they receive the pages that they keep reading, you just have to keep somebody turning that page. So, and I had already, it was my fourth complete manuscript. So I had written three full books before I wrote Stork. So I think that I had improved. My craft had improved.
Is one of those earlier three books the adult book that's coming out?
It is, yes. So the third book I ever wrote is The McLeod Home for Wayward Girls. And it sold after Stork. It was actually out making the rounds while I was writing Stork. That is how long it can take to sell a book. And I think adult fiction has had a tougher time recently, particularly women's fiction for whatever reason. And things are cyclical. Things get hot and they get popular. So the YA, the young adult, has been incredibly popular right now. And when you saw what agents were actively searching for, mostly I was reading that almost everybody was saying, and I would love to look at a young adult project. I would look at any young adult project. So I sort of put it not on hold. It certainly was out. It was out as a full with another agent for several months. So it was a book I'd written prior to Stork, but it sold after Stork.
And how does that work when you have two agents?
I don't have two agents, but this other agent had never offered me any representation. I was in complete limbo. And she's under no obligation to take me. I'm under no obligation that she's reading it. I think it's just understood in the industry that until you actually, I signed a contract with my agent once she took me on.
With Jamie?
With Jamie Brenner, yes.
I see, okay.
Yeah.
Did Jamie then sell the adult book for
She did, you? Yes. Yes, later.
And how was it different? I'd like to talk about all aspects of the difference between YA and adult. So was there a difference in the writing process?
Well, for a young adult, and it's certainly no hard and fast rule, the majority of young adult novels are written in the first person, I voice. It just feels closer. It feels like it's one individual story. You get really deep into their thoughts and feelings. With all of my, I had three full manuscripts I've written now in women's fiction. I generally go third person, what they call third person close. So I vary chapter to chapter. Generally, several different generations. So it might be a woman in her 60s or 70s, and then an adult daughter. And I always had a teenage character. So I usually have three voices that I'm kind of alternating, and I'll go back, with flashbacks into some of the past events. So I think that the difference between YA, for me anyway, and adult is I use a different perspective, a different voice, third person with adult, and really do visit other past events, historical, go back into the family history, the good stuff, all the gossip. And
sort of like Ann Tyler always had that multi-generational.
Yes, I love Ann Tyler.
Yeah, that's I will look forward to reading your adult book when it comes out. And so was it any different working with your agent on the YA than with the adult, or was it just pretty much the same process?
No, I do really love my agent. She is somebody that likes to edit. Not all agents are editing agents. Some agents really just will take it as it is, but she likes to read it and have some input, and I have done not major rewrites, but I've done rewrites on Stork and on the McLeod Home for Wayward Girls for my agent before we even sent it out to the editors, just because she has some good opinions and I respect her opinion. And I think one of the greatest things for me is it has been a learning journey, and I am certainly not above being edited. I think it makes the book stronger.
How much experience? You said you had to pad your bio a little, or at least make it sound as much as it was. And so how much writing experience had you had when you sent your query to Jamie?
Well, virtually none. That I had, really, in order to say I had freelance experience, I just found a couple of local writing assignments that I did in Waukee. I interviewed some teachers for a very small local publication, and enough to say I'm a freelance writer. Somebody asked me to do a magazine article on, it was a food and nutrition and health piece that I wrote. However, because fiction writing is so different anyway, it's not like magazine writing. I don't think it would have helped me regardless if I'd had all these years of writing for publication. But I had written a few short stories in my 20s, too busy probably in my 30s, working, getting through grad school.
Had you submitted anything?
No.
So, but you had been writing because you had written these three novels before.
Well, yeah. Once I decided that, this sort of late in life, I thought, what would be my fantasy? What would be my dream job? I had a little bit of a health scare, and I just decided as a wake up call to myself, in my dream of dreams, what's the job I want? And it was to write a novel. I mean, how wonderful. I mean, I get to the end of a great book and I think, how do I get that job? Or how do you do that? So I just, the first thing I did is I sat down the day my son went to first grade, my youngest son, I sat down and started writing. And it was this huge secret, this delicious secret that I had. And even my husband didn't know I was writing
even
a novel.
Even your husband didn't know?
No, it took me from September to June and I wrote a book. I wrote every day. I just kept, that was my first one ever, and it was horrible. It was awful. I made all the mistakes you shouldn't make. But once I knew I loved the process and I could keep my butt in the chair for, that many hours, then I signed up for the UCLA Writers Extension Program, and I did a full year of writing classes.
Oh, interesting. So, let's see. That intrigues me that even your husband didn't know.
I didn't know. It was so funny.
But what became of that first book? Did you ever try to submit it?
Oh, nothing will ever happen to that book. That book
you didn't even try to submit it.
No,
anyway.
Well, I did. I started querying that. Just you don't know how strong your work is, and I did send out not very many. I think I realized fairly quickly that not only that I still had a lot to learn, that it really wasn't a fresh enough idea. It was an idea that had been done, and you know, just yeah. I believe it was a divorce story, and I knew fairly quickly that that was not going to sell. However, just the experience of it was enough. I knew right away.
It gave you the belief in yourself that you could go invest in taking this year's worth of classes.
Absolutely. And then I think the most important thing I discovered was that I just loved the process. You know, regardless of, I was old enough that this really was, you know, an over the rainbow dream for me. So there's
and,
a good.
And here you've kind of made it come true.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, I have. And so I had nothing to lose, I guess, is where I was at that point. And the fact that I just loved the process so much was just so inspiring. So even if I had, I mean, obviously it would have been a great success, regardless of whether it had been published or not, that I just enjoyed it so much. And I set a goal and I finished that goal.
Yeah, that's cool. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Writers' Voices at KRUU 100.1 FM. The voice of Fairfield and beyond. KRUU is a community-supported solar-powered station. With me today, I have Wendy Del Sol. She is an author, newly published, has three books coming out in rapid succession. She's living near Des Moines, Iowa, in Waukee. And in just a few minutes, perhaps you could read us an excerpt from your book.
I'd love to.
You mentioned that you had mailed out your, this has to do with rejection and this question is related to how you deal with rejection. So you had sent out your first book, some queries.
A few, yes.
And nothing much came of that. And I'm also curious, one question is how you withstood that rejection. And then when you sent out your query to the woman who became your agent, Jamie Brenner, you had sent out queries to other people at the same time. Did anybody else respond the way she did?
Well, she really had such an enthusiastic response to it that there was no need to. I just stopped at that point because I really felt a great karma with Jamie. And I really, once she was that excited about the project, I stopped even following up on anybody who had the query. I think I've lost a track of
that. Yeah, well, I asked you two questions at once because I was afraid
I know, I'm trying to remember what the first part of it was.
The first one was, so before you got that enthusiastic response from the person who's now your agent, you endured some rejections from other people.
That's why I didn't remember it, because we're going to talk about rejection, yes. I think all writers have to have a few rejection because writing is such a personal thing. Not everybody's going to love even the finished product, even once it's been through all those editorial phases. So I think it's a very, very important process to go through because it does give you a little bit of a thicker skin, and you're going to need a thick skin in this business. And I think on my second book, which will also never, ever be published, I think I had at least 50 rejections.
50 rejections?
Yeah.
So that was an adult novel.
It was an adult novel, yes. And certainly I had 50. And I think I have said that I will always stop querying something once I hit the 50 mark on rejections. And I think, but you know, because I'd had quite a few rejections even on the McLeod Home for Wayward Girls. And I had stopped, really, I put it aside and I decided to work on Stork. And so that one also had its fair share of rejections. So, you know, you can't take it personally. You can't take, every writer comes to a book with their own set of expectations or where they thought that story would go, or they might read something in the jacket flap and they don't think it adequately described the book. There are so many things that come in. The reader brings as much to a book as the writer brings to a book. Rejection is just, it doesn't feel great, obviously. Nobody likes rejection, and I think those of us who are well suited to all those, you know, introspective hours at home probably like it less than the average person. However, it is a part of the business, and Just move on.
Yeah, and we will move on from rejection to success and have you read a little bit for us from your novel, Stork, which came out in October from Candlewick.
Okay. All right, well, I'm going to start with chapter one so that we avoid any spoilers, and we'll read a few pages here. So, chapter one. One moment I was fined, and the next it felt like an army of fire ants was marching across my head. Seriously, fire ants wearing combat boots. Heavy, cleated combat boots. I'd never experienced anything like it. I scratched at my scalp until my hand cramped. It didn't help. I turned, and the mirror behind the cash register confirmed my suspicions. Along with the crazy rash creeping from under my hairline, I also had claw marks. Any other head of hair would conceal such blemishes. Not mine. My tow-headed, sun-fearing ancestors had seen to that. I opened the cupboard under the register. Where was that woolen beret I'd seen? Crimson-red with a small loop on top. A bit of a fashion stretch, even for me. Oh, well. This town already thought I was odd. The suspicious package dropped at their door. I shrugged the hat over my head. It provided no relief, but at least it covered the damage. Where the heck was that delivery? My offie, my grandfather, had told me I could close as soon as Schnosen Farms delivered the apples. I looked at the old clock above the candy counter. 9 o'clock. Offie had said the bushels would arrive at 7. Hoping to see headlights barreling down Main, I looked outside. Across the street, a light in Hulda's Fabric and Notions caught my eye. No way. I'd been waiting for a sign of life in the place for weeks. The going-out-of-business sign and unclaimed bolts of fabric, glorious pristine fabric, had been taunting me as a bargain opportunity. I quickly scribbled back in 5 on a piece of paper and taped it to the door. Schnosen Farms and their golden pippins could wait. Clutching my juicy couture velour jacket to my throat, I hurried across the road. Dang, it was cold. Mid-September, and already something the Minnesota yokels called an Alberta clipper was bearing down from the north. In California, I'd still be in shorts, spaghetti straps, and flip-flops. A chime tinkled above my head as I stepped over the threshold. Holy crap, it smelled worse than my grandfather's store. Something I hadn't thought possible. Like something died. No, worse. Like something got caught in the act of dying. Some long, lingering, putrefying fade. I knew the feeling. For me, it was junior year at Norris Falls High. Exile High, as I like to call it. Who's there? The voice sounded cracked with age. I looked up to see an old ball of a woman with skin more crushed and textured than the bolts of velvet she stood over. Tufts of charcoal gray hair escaped from under an orange hat with floral trim. She looked like a shriveled root dangling under a flower pot. I saw the light, I said. I've wanted to look at your shop for weeks now. I took a hesitant step farther into the store. The old lady, dressed in a drab gray skirt and dull gray cardigan, checked the time. No, it's too late. You come back again.
I think one of the reasons I particularly liked your first chapter was because my mother was a seamstress, and we didn't go many places together. One of the few places we did go was fabric stores, you know, and so I really enjoyed. That was one aspect of your character that I think made her not just a fashion bug, but she's also kind of fashioning these clothes for herself.
Yeah, she's an aspiring designer, so she does think about the fabric and the textile and the buttons and the shimmering. Yeah, that was fun to play with.
Do some of the work herself, so I really enjoyed that part. Another part of the book that comes later, and we don't want to say anything that will spoil the experience of reading it because it does have a lot of surprises, but you do create a bad guy.
Yes, there is a
really bad guy, and I was just curious, like, I'm just assuming most of the people you know are not like this character.
Well, this one was probably an easy bad guy to write because he really is, you know, the archetype of a bad guy. He's just pure evil. He really, and because this is fantasy, we can say that there is good and there is evil. I think the harder bad guy to write is something in the genre of adult fiction where there are these shades of gray. And really everybody comes to a situation, let's say it could just be at like a tug of war over a piece of property, or where there really are two valid sides to something. Yet, from your your main character's perspective, that person is their enemy. But so those are harder to write. But for this one, this bad guy really does just have evil in his soul. So,
well, you mentioned archetypes, and I'm wondering, as you were writing this fantasy, did you consult any sort of resource that gave you some kind of a paradigm for creating a fantasy and the kind of characters that you needed to have?
That probably would have been a good thing to do, eh? I don't know that I did that. No, I think I really...
I don't know if such a thing actually even exists, but if it did, I'd like
it
to
tell. In hindsight, I think I have read some of the more formulaic, the way that you... they break it down into acts. And for me, storytelling, it is just something that I think the pacing and building in your subplots, because every character there's more than one conflict going on, more than one character with a problem. The father has, he's possibly relocating his business, and the mother is in a new relationship. So there are all these other subplots. So you start with a lot of threads in a story, and you throw them in at the beginning, you wrap them in. So we were talking about fabric, or you start tugging these threads, you pull them through. So in my mind, it's almost just a natural pacing that I, as a storyteller, I haven't gone back to the dad story recently. So after a certain amount of chapters, so you do end up having these kind of mini arcs or, many subplots going through. You have your main plot, but her romance, for instance, is another subplot, her romance in the story. And I don't know, I think it's just a natural, for me, it came naturally when to pull the other stories through, when to finish that story and to have the big climactic end at the end with the main plot.
Do you feel you might have gained that natural ability to weave those different stories together through, just doing a lot of reading?
Yes, absolutely. And movies, too. Any story that you carry from beginning to end, I think you learn something about, even if you don't, break it down into some formula, or I know I've been into some writing, I have taken writing classes now, and they do want to think about the arcs of the story, and quite honestly, I get a little lost at some point when it becomes just too analytical, the whole process. So I think that it's just something that you naturally, I don't know, as a writer, I think that, and what you're writing is so interesting that you don't even want to you don't want to stop writing because you need to know what happened. Because you also get caught up in this story with these people.
So the story's unfolding for you the way that it unfolds.
Absolutely.
In some ways for the reader. What was the process of working on your story like once you had your editor? And your editor is
Jennifer Yoon with Candlewick Press. Yeah, that it was quite smooth. Jennifer's a very, very smart woman, and she had some great ideas. And I guess she did not make any book that is edited. Obviously, there are changes that are made to it, and it's not just the simple, instead of making this a summary, let's break it out and make it a scene with dialogue and... But there, something might happen a little bit earlier in the story, and she might suggest take something from the end of the book, for instance, and say, "I want this to be introduced earlier in the book." Mm. So the whole concept of this is already something that the reader is familiar with, which sounds like it would be very simple to do. But of course, that changes every scene in the book from that point on, because we've already introduced, or maybe a character came in earlier. So those little changes that seem it's easy enough to do in that one scene and introduce them now or that. But then what you have to do, which is really where I find editing painful, is that every scene from there on has to be read and dealt with that knowledge already now have been moved earlier.
Hmm.
It's like I've likened it to a strip of animation. And if you change something physical about a character in an early strip of animation, you have to go back and redraw every frame after that because you've made that change.
Yeah, so there could be really subtle things in
Absolutely.
The way that a character reacts.
That dialogue might not, because if they already have that knowledge, the dialogue between them, the next conversation will be different. So those are the sort of things that come up in the editing process. The one change really isn't that hard to make, but it's the domino effect
right.
it has on every other scene after it.
Was the editorial process what you expected, or was that sort of surprising?
For the most part, yes. I would say I expected the amount, and, well, we're so lucky when to have such... it really is lucky to have somebody look at your work so closely, and you are so married to it that you might not understand... she could say, this confuses me. And whereas you think, well, I wrote it. It seems clear to me. However, it helps so much to have fresh eyes, smart people looking at it and checking it for flow and consistency and all those things that
editors
do.
Somebody with a real vested interest and commitment to it. I want to remind listeners, this is Writers' Voices. You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield and beyond. KRUU is a community-supported, solar-powered radio station. With me today is Wendy Del Sol. She is from a recent transplant, been in Iowa for about the last 5 years, living in Waukee. And we're discussing her experience having just published Stork and having two more novels coming out in the next year or two. So I'm curious how having a published book has changed your life.
Oh, wow. I don't even know that it has changed my life so much. My day-to-day life is, I would say, is fairly consistent to what it was before. It has been a great experience just to show my boys that it's never too late. I would encourage anyone that really has an interest in something that, you know, explore it, ask questions. I really... felt very empowered that at age 40 I was able to kind of, you know, barrel my way into something I really wanted to do. So whether or not it's changed my day-to-day life, it really has been a wonderful personal journey.
We were talking about having readers who really look closely at your work, and I'm curious if you had any first readers before your agent and your editor, before you sent it to your... It sounds like you didn't have time to show it to anyone before you sent it to your agent.
I do have a critique group in the Des Moines area, and my friend Kimberly Stewart, she just published her fifth novel, Operation Bonnet, and she and I met at the University of Iowa Summer Writing Festival. So she was one of my first writer friends here in Iowa. We took Kelly Dwyer's The Middle of the Novel class. It was the book, the course we took together. So we bonded that weekend and kept in touch. So once we were back in Des Moines, we started our critique group. And I was listening to a radio interview, funny enough, with another local writer, Kelly Vambali, who wrote A Space Between. And I sent her an email. I found her website. I sent her an email and said, well, Kimberly Stewart and I are... And she said, well, yeah. So she came and met us. So then we were three. Actually, a neighbor of mine as well is a mystery writer, unpublished as of yet, but has a manuscript she's ready to go out with. Callie brought in a friend, Merle, and there was another friend, Chantal, who was in the group as well. So we had six of us. Chantal has since moved to Vegas. So I do have first readers. We call ourselves a critique group. We meet once a month. Not everyone, about three people a meeting submit up to 20 pages, and we read for clarity content. We don't generally worry about grammar, but just wording and all the things that another writer might pick up that this might be better told, not as a memory, but let's experience that for real type.
So your critique group is, you've collected people through these different ways, partly through the Iowa Summer Writing Festival.
Yes.
That interests me because I teach there and I'll be teaching there again this summer. It's a great place for networking. And so you meet, it sounds like you circulate your manuscripts ahead of time because it'd be hard to read 60 pages during a meeting.
Yes, we send them, you know, over email a 1 week prior. We get our red pens out during the week, and then we come in with our marked up pages, and one by one we go through our pages for the entire group. We discuss what we changed or what we like. Mostly it really is about... honestly, finding the spots that work, that yes, more of this, or this humor is great, this word choice this is what really kept me turning the pages. That
is this pretty much a harmonious process?
It is. We have so much fun. Oh my goodness, we laugh so much. We actually do meet in my basement just because it's a nice, quiet place, and it's easiest for everyone. My kids are probably the oldest, so there's less disruption to my family. And I think that my husband sometimes says, you guys were loud down there. Because it really is it's a great group of women. It's an excuse for a women's night as well.
Do you have any kind of ritual you use to celebrate when somebody sells a book?
We've opened a bottle of champagne among the group before, and just Kimberly Stewart just had her launch at the Des Moines Central Library, and we came out in full force and supported her. We've since, branched out and met other writers mostly in the Des Moines area, but you know, I am active with SCBWI as well, the Society of Children Book Writers and Illustrators, and have met wonderful people through SCBWI as well.
Yes, and SCBWI is having its 20th anniversary this year, and I understand you're going to be one of the people leading a session at the spring conference.
I am going to do a breakout session on what to expect the first year. So everything from agent, the contract, different types of offers you might be presented. You could get a preempt or it could go to auction, and then all the way through the editorial process and marketing, social media, all the
well, you're
your first
cover,
year.
Covering a lot of territory there.
I'm going to try.
And so I think that we are not real sure when that is, but we're thinking that the date is set.
I believe it's the first weekend of April.
In April, and the place people could find out is by going to Iowa SCBWI online, and that would have information. So you can just Google Iowa SCBWI if you are interested in attending that conference, which is open to anyone interested in writing or illustrating children's books. So you've had a lot of experiences now with writing. Is there any writing advice that you got along the way that you now look back at and think was worthless or bad advice?
Yeah, I don't know if it's worthless, but I think that one of the most thrown around pieces of advice in the writing community is write what you know, which I just think is not all as helpful as it could be, that write what you know. Honestly, write what you're interested in, absolutely. Write what you want to know about, yes. But to write what you know, it's too limiting, and it's one of those platitudes that I've always bristled at a little bit, just because I think that, have fun. Honestly, I didn't know anything about it, and it's fiction, too. So I write fiction, so let's just see where it can take you.
I suspect nonfiction writers, too, like researching something new and finding out more.
You're not
about
limited
something.
To everything you already know is, I guess, what I want to say about that one adage that so many writers are told, write what you know.
I guess that could feel like a limiting, if someone is thinking, my life is sort of dull.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
What do I have to write about? So I could see where you might want to...
No, life is dull. I mean, honestly, you could live in the same small town and find a different story by talking to a new person every day of the year.
So what is, do you think, really valid, some of the best writing advice you've ever gotten?
Well, I think that just treating it like a business, not a business per se, but a job. And I would say that if I were to boil my success down to one thing, it would just be this stick-to-itiveness that I have developed. And I set word goals. And for years, writing into this dark tunnel of, I wasn't published. I had no guarantee that I would ever be published. But I just had this determination, and I wrote book after book without really having any measure of success at that point. But it's just, there's a... I guess you just treat it like a job. I would get I like to set a goal of 500 words a day. After I write my 500 words a day, then I'm free to do other things. Or I really do try to be very, very diligent in that 500 Monday through Friday, that's 2,500 words a week. That's 10,000 words a month. A book is about 80,000 words. So in 8 months, you could have a manuscript.
Oh, that's a nice way to look at it.
Yeah.
So before you'd start, you'd have to have sort of a skeleton of what you were aiming for.
Yeah, it helps to have an outline. Absolutely. I know every writer has some, that is the whole debate in writing. Are you a pantser, which is a seat of your pants writer, or are you a plotter? And I think I'm somewhere in between. I write kind of guideposts, so big events that are going to get me to the end of the book. But I don't have it. I know I've seen J.K. Rowling's outline or diagram that she had done for all seven books. It's out there now. And it's crazy, the detail she already had. I don't have that much, but I do have... So I'm sort of in between the two. So I think that helps.
So you've told us you're now working on the third book in your trilogy. Oh, and what's the title of that one? Do you know what the title will be?
I wish I did. I honestly do not know the title. It had a title. Then somebody else published, and I'm not even going to say that title because it would actually be a little bit of a spoiler. However, I am now have a working idea, but
not quite there yet.
No, it will be a one word. The sequel is Frost.
Right, so we have Stork Frost.
Frost, and I'm hoping to find just a one-word title that will. I know what when I type it, it will. It'll be. I know it, and I haven't got there yet, though.
And are you working on anything else as well as Frost? Do you have something else that's percolating?
I do have a couple things percolating. I had another YA project. I think I'm 20,000 words into that, so that may be a quarter of the way through. I had started that after Stork and sort of while I was waiting for the editorial process with Frost. And so I'll probably pick that back up, but I also have some ideas for some more adult fiction as well. It'll be nice to have this trilogy behind me and start something fresh. As much as I love these characters, there's always that open road ahead of you as well.
So I want to remind listeners that with me today is Wendy Del Sol. She's an author from now living near Des Moines, Iowa, in Waukee, and she has had three books come out very recently. And do you have any final words you want to share with us about the writing process?
I just want to thank you for having me. This has been my first time on the radio, so it's been a wonderful new experience. My first time in Fairfield, Iowa, too, so thank you for inviting me.
Well, we're thrilled that you could come and share your experiences with us. It's especially interesting because you're a first-time author, and anyone who's interested in learning more can visit your website. Do you want to tell us what your website is?
It's www.wendydelsol.com, D-E-L-S-O-L.
And also, Wendy will be a speaker at the Iowa SCBWI conference in April, and you can look for information on that online. Thank you for being with me today,
Wendy. Thank you so much for having me.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.